Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So, yes, Mr. Henry Smith, delighted to have you on Moments That Rock podcast, because, my God, have I been looking forward to your moment, sir. You started, like, in the music business, for want of a better word, like, really at a top level with a band like the Yardbirds in that whole explosion of the 60s, didn't you? So tell us about a little bit about those days.
Hey there, I'm Henry Smith. How are you? Hope you all are having a good day today. And I'm here with Tony. Tony's such a great guy. He came from England years ago to the US. I don't know why he ever did that. Where he was Tony the Greek. He had a radio show. I think that's where I first ever heard about Tony.
Really? But,
yeah. So I'll do enough of that and I'll get on to me. I was a young lad in Connecticut, back in the early 50s. I was born in the late 40s. I hate to even think about that. I'm almost 77 now. But so my parents got a divorce, and I moved up to stayed in Connecticut and would go up to New Hampshire in the summer times. And there was this young band that was playing in and around there at the time. And they were from New York, from Yonkers, New York, a band called The Strangers. And they had this young drummer who I made friends with. And hold on, Tony, one sec. My dogs are going nuts. Come on, kids. Come on in. They'll be quiet if they're in here. They'll bark if they can't. So, hey, you just made a liar of me. Lay down. So in the summer times, I'd go up and see my father, and there was this young band called The Strangers, and they had this young drummer who lived in New York and came up, and his parents had this efficiency cabin place that this gentleman's grandfather had started for young musicians or musicians in New York City who couldn't get away in this, or couldn't even afford to get away, but they could take a train ride up to New Hampshire. And this would have been back in the 30s and 40s that he did this. So I ended up becoming pretty good friends with that whole band. And I would help them out in getting shows and things like that in Connecticut. I got them in my high school. I got them other shows around. We invented our own shows in New Hampshire at a ski resort. Well, the drummer's name was Stephen Tallarico. And Stephen always wanted to be a lead singer. That was his dream. He had this room with posters on the ceiling. It was in the attic, so it was kind of a cathedral ceiling in a three-level house. It wasn't three stories, but three levels. I moved in there when I got out of high school. His parents let me come in and stay there. Well, he had two single beds. I had one bed. He had the other, and would sit around and smoke joints at night and blow it out the window so the parents wouldn't know. He had this ball that had fluorescent paint on it with a little hook in the ceiling, and he would try to get the ball to land on the hook. And when the ball came back again, you had to keep your head down because it would just miss your nose. Just dumb things that people would do. Well, Stephen was an interesting guy, and he ended up becoming a lead singer. At the end of the Chain Reaction, they got another drummer came in, a guy named Barry Shapiro, came in, played drums. Stephen learned how to be a lead singer, and he was really good at it. He just had a way of carrying a crowd. Well, he later became Steven Tyler, and he started the band Aerosmith. Well, backing up a little bit, between the Chain Reaction and when Aerosmith started, I got a call at Thanksgiving time while in New Hampshire. Steven and I were living in the big house, which is where his parents and uncle lived during the summer. We stayed there for the winter. We had permission. Thanksgiving Day, I get a call from Barry Reese. Now, Barry Reese worked for Steven Weiss. And Steven Weiss was the attorney that most English bands used when they came to the U.S. I mean, there was a lot of them that Steve was the attorney for. And one of those bands was the Yardbirds, and then Zeppelin, bands that I worked for. So Barry gives me a call, said, "Can you come to England? Yardbirds are going to do a little tour, and they want you to come and do it." Jimmy asked for me. So I said, "Sure." Well, it was snowing out. I had to go about 20 miles to get to my father's house so I could get a suitcase and some clothes. Well, that was out of the question. So I ended up putting clothes in a paper bag, just a regular brown shopping bag. I took my clothes and a little tool kit and flew off to merry old London. I took a bus from New Hampshire down to Boston, because the buses never stopped. They kept running. Get there. I get to the other end. And one thing that Steve Weiss told me, he said, "Don't tell them you're working." Okay. Well, I show up with a toolbox and my clothes at customs. And this gentleman looks at me and "What will you be doing here?" "Oh, I'm here to see Mr. Peter Grant." "Oh, 1 minute." And he leaves, goes and comes back with a manila envelope, one of those 8x11 or whatever they are, envelopes. My name is on the outside with the flight number. This guy gives it to me and says, "Your lorry is in the parking lot." Well, lorry to me is a girl's name. I didn't know it was a truck. I figured it out, but he gives me the thing. I go out, I look, and there's a note from Richard Cole with a map showing me how to get around the roundabouts and to get on the M way to go south to get to Dover to take a ferry. And I had to be there at a certain time, naturally. So now I'm driving on the wrong side of the road, something I've never experienced before, not even being drunk. Driving down the highway, I get to Dover, I get on the ferry, everything is working perfectly. Get to the other end. Gotta go to drive to Paris from, I forgot the name of the dock you get off at, but. So I drive into Paris. The first sign I see for Paris, I go, "Well, I better get off. I don't know how big Paris is." Well, I found out real quick, what they call Paris is big. It's not all just downtown. It stretches it feels like days. You feel like you're in Texas. You just go exit after exit, Paris, Paris, Paris. How can there be so many? I get off. And I got this brilliant idea of pulling a cabbie over and telling him, showing him the address of where I got to go. And I'll pay him and I'll follow him and I'll get to the gig. So I do this tour with the Yardbirds in Europe and had a great time. Jimmy asked me if I would stay with him because the Yardbirds had broken up. They'd done their last shows. And I kind of knew that from the U.S. because he had mentioned it then. And he said, look, I'm starting this new band. Would you work with me? I went, oh, Jimmy, I would love to. Well, the same day, Keith Ralph comes up to me and said, I'm starting a new band with Jim McCarty. We would love to have you come with us. And now I'm drawn because they were my friends. You get to be friends when you're on the road. It's like a marriage of sorts, especially back in the 60s when you had one roadie. You didn't have a plethora of buses and planes and trucks and people. It was just you and a truck and the band.
Yeah.
And that was it. And those were great times. So now I've been offered these two jobs in one day to go with these either bands, and nobody really had a name for a band. Pagey knew who he was going to have for a bass player, but he didn't know who the drummer or the singer was going to be at the time. And I've read different ways on how Jimmy and Jonesy got together on this, but the way I remember it was that Jimmy called Jonesy. Jonesy wasn't home. He was doing a session. He talked to Jonesy's wife, Mo, who said, yes, John will do it. Didn't even ask John. She just said, yes, he'll do it. And that's how that started from what I remember. And I remember because we laughed about it a few times, Jimmy going, oh, well, now we know who runs that family.
So do you feel that kind of the connection with Peter Grant drifted you more towards the Jimmy Page side than the Keith?
Well, Jimmy, I had to make a decision, and Peter came up and told me, you'll be going with Jimmy.
So why did he even ask you?
Yeah, right. Kind of wrap that one up. So I was working basically with Peter Grant bands at the time. Nothing wrong with the Yardbirds, nothing wrong with Jimmy's new band Led Zeppelin. So I lived in London. I kind of felt like I was an English roadie, not an American roadie. I knew far more English musicians than I knew American musicians at that time. You know, they were just the people that I did things with. It wasn't like I was a groupie or something. They were just my friends. You know, you wake up in the morning, you get a call from Jimmy Page to go do this, go do that, can pick me up at this time because Jimmy didn't have a license. Pick me up at this time or that time and we're going to go do this or go do that. We used to go to auctions. Jimmy's a great auction guy. He has a time period of things that he loves. Art Deco, Art Nouveau period. So Jimmy would go, okay, look, I'm going to go sit down front. Here's my card, because you got to have a card with a number on it. And he'd get me a card, and I'd go sit in the back of the room. And Jimmy would start bidding on something. Well, if somebody else started to bid against him, he would stop, and I would start. And these people would go, oh, geez, this guy's just starting. I guess I better back out. Pagey had it down. He knew this game really well. So he would play all different kinds of cool artwork. And that was just driving around with him on weekdays or weekends or whatever.
Amazing stuff from Henry Smith. Actually, that should be Henry Smith and the Growling Hounds. I'll never edit Growling Dogs out of these podcasts. Moments the Rock is part of the Pantheon group of podcasts. This is great. I'm loving it. Jimmy Page is right-hand man right from the get-go in the Yardbirds and before and beyond. We'll be back with more of Henry and some John Bonham stories after this short break. And then we'll have more episodes with them.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Henry, in weeks to come.
At the beginning of Zeppelin, Robert Plant lived in Birmingham, in a little town called Kidderminster, just outside of Birmingham, just to the west, I think it would be. And he had this place, Jennings Farm. Well, Robert worked on the roads. He did tarmacking on paving the roads. Dog, I don't need your help. And Jimmy would have me pick him up, bring him down to Jimmy's place so that they could start rehearsing. But before he let him in the house, he had to clean up. He had to take his shoes off and change his clothes. Jimmy wouldn't let him in otherwise.
So this was pre Bonzo then. There were three of them first, and then John Bonham at the end.
Bonham came before the rehearsals started. That was the Keith Moon thing. Mooney mentioned to Jimmy that he knew this great drummer and that he should at least go see him. So Richard, myself, Jimmy, and Mooney all went to this club in Manchester to see this band, the Band of Joy. And the Band of Joy had Bonzo was the drummer. Well, they also had the lead singer that we didn't know anything about. So Pagey is sitting there going, yeah, the drummer's awesome. We'll take the drummer. And he goes, when they take a break, I'm going to go into the dressing room. And I said, okay. And I went with him. We went in and sat down. Jimmy introduced himself like he had to. And that's when Bonzo entered. Well, at the same time, Jimmy was just head over heels for the singer, which was Robert Plant. Because at the time, it was going to be Terry Reed was going to be the drummer. I was going to be the singer.
Right. It
was going to be the singer. But Terry also played guitar. So I don't know if they were going to have a rhythm guitar player that sang or what. I'm not sure what that was going to be like.
What a great kind of initiation for you, kind of as Peter Grant and Jimmy Page were growing into what they became. You were kind of just rolling with it.
I just got drugged along because Pagey didn't have a license and he had to get to these places. So somebody had to drive. So when we weren't on the road, my job was to drive for Pagey, of which was an absolute pleasure. He's such a gentleman. He's a wonderful, wonderful guy. We still talk today, just as friends.
Led Zeppelin's legacy will forever be left in place. What do you feel having been around somebody like Peter Grant, I mean, because I subconsciously learned so much from great managers, you know, the Paul McGuinnesses, the Michael Whitmans and stuff. You know, I've heard these stories, you know, through my interest in Led Zeppelin things, but he never had a contract with the band, did he?
No, handshake with Jimmy. See, in the beginning, it was just Jimmy and three guys that he hired to work with him. I kind of look at it like they were almost the first boy band.
Yeah.
You know, one guy came up with an idea between Jimmy and Peter, and Jimmy then built a band around it, around the idea with musicians that would fit.
Because it's funny, because you read about Peter Grant, and it's kind of fearless, isn't it? And it's kind of the word intimidating and stuff and things like that. Well, I mean, at the end of the day, he was so protective of his act, wasn't he? I mean, if you interfered and took money away from that band, then you had it. And the other thing is, another important person in the mix was Ahmed Ertegun, right?
Yes. Peter was a roadie at one time. Can't remember the geezer's name, but he worked for this for a management company, kind of like I did working with Peter, where I just did whatever bands. And Don Arden.
Don Arden, yeah. I saw that on his Wikipedia page. Well, Don Arden's got a fair reputation, so, you know. I don't think Don Arden would have been hanging Peter Grant over a balcony to sign a contract, however.
Yeah, I'll bet. So what happened with Peter is, and what kind of shaped, I think, some of how he thought was that he saw how bad black musicians were treated. And he didn't want his bands, if he was going to be a manager, he didn't want his bands to be treated the way black musicians were, because those were most of the bands that Arden had. He had a lot of the older black bands.
Oh, didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't either until I knew that. Well, I knew it then, but I didn't know it before that.
I've read things like, Ahmed Ertegun like comes to the band with suggestions of releasing singles, and Peter says, well, why would we release singles when we can release albums? Because they wanted to put a whole lot of love out and stuff and things like that. And Peter Grant, if I'm not mistaken, rewrote the model for touring bands, because in those days the promoters were getting all the money, and he was saying, well, 90% of 10% of Led Zeppelin is worth more than 90% of most bands.
Yeah, and that's very true. And that's what Peter, being an ex-wrestler, he was a big man, very large man.
He was a really big man until John Bonham died. I mean, I know what you're saying by stature-wise, but I mean, that kind of almost like turned into like, big as he was, into kind of a timid, like, older guy then, wasn't it? It was devastating for him.
Yeah.
He became a recluse, didn't he?
Yeah, kind of put him, and it wasn't so, I think Peter felt as though maybe he let them down.
Really?
That's only my thought.
Well, you were there.
That was my thought, is that Peter felt as though he let them down because Bonzo died. And there were many times Bonzo was almost out of the band.
I remember
getting too pissed, you know, and Jimmy didn't like that. But at the same time, they were getting high, so.
I remember... I don't know if you were probably in the States then, but there was there was a conference in Manchester called In the City, and Peter Grant made a presentation there, you know, and I remember like going in this room, of course it was full, and I was kind of on the second row, and he was in one chair, and Tony Wilson was kind of the interviewer. He owned Factory, but he was a presenter for Granada TV as well. And he asked him the obvious question about, you know, did you ever think of continuing? And, you know, and you could see the look on his face, and he was saying that there is no Led Zeppelin without John Bonham. It's very moving.
Yeah. And it was, even with Peter, it would be like, why start another band? Because nobody's going to be as big as Zeppelin was. And it's like, you almost feel like you would have failed. And that's why I feel like Peter felt as though he failed them. By not being, and it was nothing he could have done about it.
Well, the thing is, to his credit, I mean, it's easy to say now because he's been past nearly 20 years, hasn't he?
Yeah.
So, you know, but the thing is, it's like, you know, the passion for the band and the relationship with the label and what, because I read that Ahmed Oettingen met signed Led Zeppelin within 15 minutes of meeting him, you know. And yeah, the thing with Zeppelin, I mean, feel free to interrupt me and tell me I'm wrong. I'm just using stuff that I've learned over the years from articles I've read and stuff and things. They never got any good press or anything. They had nobody behind them. They did it all from just playing to fans. I mean, talk about old school or inventing a model that has never failed, because that's what happened with whether it was even Bush, never mind U2 and bands like that, that just schlepped around and played every shithole and worked their way up and had a fan base that was so dedicated.
Yeah, we never played shitholes.
Right from the beginning, you didn't play clubs and things.
No, they didn't come up as a band playing every shithole in the U.S. We played some small theaters.
So you never went out to play to 50 people or anything? You went out to like a few hundred from the beginning?
Pretty much so, yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. And that, would you think that was people just following Jimmy Page's career?
People following Jimmy Page's career, thinking it was the New Yardbirds, which was what they started, because that first tour we did in Scandinavia was as the New Yardbirds. And only because they had signed contracts already for the Yardbirds, and then the Yardbirds broke up. Peter, being the brilliance that he was, said, well, we'll just hold those gigs and call these guys the New Yardbirds.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
And it wasn't to keep that name. It was to fulfill the obligations that the band had already had.
Yeah, well, I suppose it's those days of like formally the Yardbirds on a poster, you know, to trying to make people know that they're worth seeing.
And it was smart because those were the smallest gigs that we played, which were gigs that the Yardbirds were going to headline.
They weren't
really little clubs like the Marquee Club or any of those places.
Man, there's nothing wrong with doing the Marquee Club, because I mean, it's kind of like,
No, it's a great spot, but a lot of bands start by playing in a place like the Marquee Club.
Mm. And I mean, even though Jimmy Page was kind of pretty young when from Yardbirds into thing, he was even doing session playing before that, wasn't he? I mean, he was a guitar player probably in his mother's womb.
Yeah, I think so. It was Jimmy. There were two Jims that were session musicians in London during the 60s. Big Jim Sullivan and Little Jimmy Page.
Little Jimmy Page. It would have been great if he'd been like a blues singer on a kind of on the beach. Yeah. That
first,
was great.
First rapper, Little Jim Page.
I know, like, you weren't, you know, your job was like on the road and stuff. But I mean, I kind of haven't worked, you know, for record companies and seeing different ways of different bands making it and stuff. I always see the management as such an important player in the bigger machine, so to speak. I often wonder if Zeppelin would have become the institution they were if they'd assigned to a different label. I actually say that about U2, because U2 allowed that band, Island Records allowed that band to develop when most labels would have dropped them. And what CEO, president of a record company, would have you telling them, this is how we're going to do it, like, we're not releasing singles? They put so much pressure on them to do what they can market and promote, don't they?
Yeah.
And Zeppelin was a different model.
About that is the cards fell for them just like they were supposed to. Ahmed Oettingen taking them on. Well, what was going on in Atlantic at that time was a guy, Mario Medias, who was a record promoter, and he worked for Atlantic. At that time, he was doing the music that was the music of the time, which was not rock and roll. He went to Ahmed Oettingen and said, I want to start promoting rock and roll bands. I think they're going to be the next big thing. And Ahmed let him do it. So when Ahmet was signing that deal with Zeppelin, he also knew that he had a guy that he could promote it, because the guy wanted to do it. It was in his heart. And Mario Medias has to me, has a lot to do with the underground of why Zeppelin made it.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic, Henry. That's amazing. I just, like I say, I love the fact that, you know, when you know, champions, so to speak, come in and change the industry as such, because so many people are frightened to have to play the corporate game to not to satisfy the investors and stuff and things like that. And I know we live in a different time and different place, but I just wonder if anything like that will ever be recreated. I mean, the only time that band has reformed was for the Armin Oettingen Foundation. And I know that story because you told it me personally, but just tell us, like, your invitation.
Oh.
Didn't the internet go down? The internet went down for tickets, didn't it?
Pardon?
The internet actually went down, the amount of requests for tickets.
Yeah. Yes, it did, when they were trying to sell the tickets off. Well, they didn't try. It happened.
The only band that could have done a year in one venue and still sold out.
I get a call from this guy, Peter Mensch, who was managing Chili Peppers and bands like that at the time. He and Cliff Bernstein. Peter goes, Jimmy wants to give you tickets to come see the band play for Ahmet's thing. And he goes, I always thought you were kidding me when you said you worked for Zeppelin. And I said, why would I kid you? And he goes, Paige, he really wants to make sure you have these tickets. So please let him know that I got them for you. Okay, fine. Well, I get a call from Tyler, who says, I got to go to London. Paige, I got to back that up. Tyler and I went to London to give Paige an achievement, Lifetime Achievement Award. Huh? And Les Paul, I had gotten a guitar from Les Paul to give to Jimmy, which was a black Les Paul, like the Black Beauty that he lost or got stolen from him, to give to him at this thing. But Jimmy didn't know I was coming.
Oh.
No, it was kind of kept quiet that I was going to be there. So we show up at this luncheon, and the cameras are all flashing for Tyler and everything. And Ross Hafflin, who's a photographer, comes over and says, I want to get pictures of Jimmy and Steven together. And I went, all right, great. Come on, let's go. So I turned the corner. Paige and I saw each other eye to eye. I mean, it was just like glued. And we both got a little tearful because I hadn't seen him in a while. And it was very cool. So it was all kind of set up.
And I remember what you told me when you came home, because I was expecting you to call and I hadn't heard for a couple of days. So I got on the phone and asked you what it was like.
It was incredible. Absolutely. I'd never heard the band so good. Paige played so well. It was magic. It was meant to happen. Even Jason Bonham, the band couldn't remember some of the tempos for the songs, some of the changes during rehearsals. Not Jason. Jason knew everything exactly the way it was on the record. And he kind of directed the band through all those rehearsals to do that.
Wow, that's incredible.
When Jason was 6 years old, he would sit on my knee in rehearsals for Zeppelin at Robert's house. He'd sit on my knee and play drums, like make the faces that his father would make, you know, and hitting the drums, and it was hysterical.
Well, I can't imagine that kind of, you know, Keith Moon recommending John Bonham. I can't imagine those nights out with those two. Oh, my God.
Mooney was crazy.
Yeah.
He was such a gentle, nice guy, but he loved to have fun.
But they happen to be amazing drummers, as well as, like, the, dare we say, decadence in their lives, you know, of kind of not helping their bodies.
No, not at all.
Were the days when you wondered, you looked around and think, I hope he makes it to the gig, you know?
He didn't make it to one gig. Well, he didn't make it with the band to one gig. Schenectady, New York. I'm up there, got all the gear set up, the band come in limos, everybody but Bonham. And I go, where's John? Oh, he's back in New York. We couldn't get him up. He got too pissed last night. So he's going to have to find his own way here or he's out of the band. Well, about an hour and a half later, this New York City cab driving into the backstage area. And it's Bonzo, $200 cab ride.
In those days.
In those days, from New York City to Schenectady.
So he made it to the gig.
Yeah, to do it. And he made the gig.
Nothing like keeping you guessing, eh?
Yeah, right. Yeah, because I don't play drums. We already knew that.
Yeah. Well, never mind. You probably been thrown in the band and you never would have got out. You know, man, you have to get paroled from Led Zeppelin, don't you? Because once you're in, you're in.
You're in.
Must be amazing to look back on all that, Henry, and see what an opportunity you had and you know, I mean, experience that you gained that took you into other things. Maybe we can pick up another time with some other stuff if you ever have, you know, wanted sure. to tell more.
Yeah, we haven't gotten very far yet.
Henry, it's been an absolute privilege. Thank you so much for giving me the time, and we'll revisit this. It's been a real pleasure.
The pleasure was all mine. Thank you.
You've been listening to Moments That Rock, part of the Pantheon Group of podcasts. I'm your host, Tony Michaelides, and we'll be back next week with some more gems. This was Henry Smith, who, like I said before, was with the Yardbirds and then working with Jimmy Page right through the career of that amazing band, Led Zeppelin. Hope you enjoyed it. Subscribe, come back for more, and tell your friends. We'll be back next week.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.